the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is the 17th of March today, St. Patrick's Day. It's now about 4 minutes after the hour of 9 a.m. Senator French is with us. I don't see him wearing any green. Senator Huggins is with us. It's just a too light a color. It's not really an Irish green.
It'll pass.
Huh?
You're outvoted, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, no. E for effort.
E for effort. Come on now, guys.
Making the quorum, and the first thing I get is...
Yeah. And I got my green pen on. And Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seegans.
I have readily available.
Yes. But we... today we're going to continue on, excuse me, with Senate Bill 67 as our first item of business. We have a committee substitute I'd like to introduce. The committee substitute basically removes the legislative findings. The rest of the bill is the same. The legislative findings, normally we clean them up and take them out of the bill here by motion from Senator Terrio. He is generally the culprit for removing legislative findings from bills. But normally we would have introduced this particular CS earlier. We drafted it on the 2nd of February. But we wanted to make sure that Senator Terrio was here to be able to move this particular draft because it does eliminate the finding sections of the bill and makes it a lot shorter. Senator Terrio, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, if it removes finding sections, absolutely. I move the /G version as a working document before the committee.
Is there objection? Hearing none. And as of course, it just all this does is eliminate the finding section, which we had planned to do since the second day of February, if you'll notice up there, is where it was drafted. So I just got around to remembering that we needed to have Senator Terrio do his duty. So that shortens this bill in terms of its number of pages down to, you can see, 2 pages. We're going to continue on with public testimony on the bill this morning. And before we do, are there any comments that any of the members would like to make prior to the beginning? Seeing none, we're going to first then go to the off-net, and we have Mike Hogan on the off-net. Mike, are you with us this morning?
I am, Senator. Thank you very much.
If you'll put yourself on the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
My name is Mike Hogan. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, which is a group of about 160 physicians here at Anchorage, primarily specialists. And I'm here to testify today in strong support of SB 67 and to supplement some of the testimony that Dr. Gower gave last week. I'd like to start by just reiterating the fact that this is a really critical issue in that access by the general public to doctors in this state was predicated on doctors being able to get and keep medical malpractice insurance. Given the fact that we're now down to just 2 carriers that will write insurance for most of the doctors in this state, we simply cannot afford to lose another one. And there is a prevailing feeling amongst the two large carriers that Alaska is not as friendly or conducive to the state as it might otherwise be. It's really important to remember that if we did lose a carrier, it would take years to recover in the sense that a lot of physicians in the state are old enough now, over half of them over 50, that they would simply have to decide whether it was risk going bare if they could not get insurance. And many of us making that decision would probably decide to try something else, either move to a different state or retire or cut back greatly on the number of the highest risk procedures that they do and that Alaskans need. Ultimately, what we're asking you to do is to make what I'll term an equitable decision, and it revolves around what is fair. And if it were one of my loved ones that were injured, quite frankly, that in a medical malpractice case, there's no amount of money that I would deem that would be fair. But society has to make these determinations, and the legislature has to do that from time to time. For example, in the auto insurance industry, in this state, there are $50,000 minimum requirements for coverage. If somebody is really harmed in an auto accident, that may be the extent of damages that they can recover, and that would include economic, non-economic, and their medical bills. And that doesn't quite seem fair, but the legislature and the state has deemed that driving, the ability to drive and to move is so important that that is what the society can afford. Again, I've been told that in the work comp system, the lowest that an injured worker can claim against disability benefits is about $800 a month under the system. Again, that seems fair. Well, that's arguable, but that's what we as a society have deemed we can all afford. And again, in this context of medical malpractice insurance, $250,000 for non-economic damages is still a lot of money. And it must be reiterated that all medical expenses and all future and past lost wages are still fully covered, as are any punitive damages. My final point will be that we also must remember that the two carriers that remain in this state are both California-based mutual companies. And the amount of business that they actually write in this state, I've deemed is nothing more than a rounding error compared to what they write in California. They will do constant evaluation as to what the risk factors are in the markets that they do business. And I think it's critical that we do everything we can in this state to keep them and try to attract additional carriers so that physicians can keep their insurance and Alaskans can still have access to the medical care that they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Hogan this morning from members? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Hogan.
Good morning.
Has your group done any analysis on what role that fraud might play in the high price of insurance?
But in the context of the two carriers that write the vast majority of the business up here, their premiums are based on that they charge physicians, from what I've been told, is based on what their claims history is. Being mutual companies, they're essentially pass-throughs. They're owned by doctors. In fact, this type of insurance is so risky now that the only people willing to really write that malinsurance are physician-owned companies. So they're not full-cost companies in that sense, and I suspect the ability to commit fraud on any large scale is rather limited in that context.
Well, the reason I asked is that there was a news report last week, Mr. Hogan, from California, actually, about, and maybe you followed that story as well, about a group of physicians there that were defrauding their insurance companies to the tune of something like $1.3 billion by sort of rounding up patients, having them brought to California, doing a bunch of unnecessary procedures on them, and then billing their insurance for those procedures and paying off the patients with something quite a bit less. And given the size of that, I mean, $1.3 billion is a lot of money. It occurred to me that that may not be the only place in the universe where that kind of fraud is taking place, and so that's just something that came to my mind, and maybe something that you would want to look at as one of the factors driving insurance rates here in the state.
Now, you're talking about medical insurance as opposed to medical liability insurance, is that correct?
The insurance claims were just standard, you know, medical claims presented to your insurance.
So these were medical services claims, Senator?
Yeah,
correct.
Not medical malpractice claims?
Correct.
Okay. Well, Senator, in the context of medical liability insurance, I mean, physicians get a premium statement from their med-mal carrier, and they either choose to pay it or not. I'm not sure if fraud in the context of physicians committing fraud in the med-mal market is is analogous to medical insurance.
Senator Seekins, I would think medical malpractice claims are normally something that has been adjudicated, or at least there has been some kind of communication between physicians' attorneys and insurance company attorneys to come to some kind of a settlement, which are all recorded in the state of Alaska. They must be reported and recorded, as I understand the law. So it would be kind of, if there's fraud, it would be between the parties that were settling the claim, but that would be pretty tough, I think. But it's worth looking at. Let the record also show that Senator Guest has joined us some time back here. Senator Guest, for your information, we've adopted /G, and that merely removes the finding sections from the bill, so nothing else has been changed. Senator French, go ahead.
Just one follow-up, and this is on a different subject. Mr. Hogan, you mentioned fairness, and I guess, you know, we're all trying to look and see and do what's fair. But one of my concerns about lowering the limits too far is that the further down you push the cap on non-economic damages, the more you injure or the more you take away claims from people who have been hurt the worst. And you can see my point. If a doctor makes a mistake working on my wrist or taking a boil off of me or something like that, and I experience a small injury, I can sue him and get a small recovery, and I'm probably going to be made whole because my claim is relatively small. That the total, if my total pain and suffering amounts to $5,000 because I'm laid up for a month, then that's fine. I'm made whole. But someone whose leg is wrongly amputated, or someone who gets injected with a poison in their system that causes them to die terribly over the course of 2 weeks, those folks whose damages are completely off the charts, those folks get hurt the most because the limit is set at $250,000. And so, when you talk about fairness, I guess I wonder how it is how it's fair to take away the people that are hurt the most. Babies that are injured tend to have lifetimes worth of injuries that can't get compensated because we've set this artificially low number. So maybe you could address how it's fair.
Well, there's a flip side to that coin, and I will address your point, but the flip side to begin with is, I think it's important to ask the question, is it fair to all of us in Alaska to put at risk the healthcare system by putting at risk physicians' ability to get and maintain malpractice insurance? The State Medical Association has run some numbers based on national statistics and concluded that there are over 30 million patient encounters a year in this state. And if you look at the number of Med-Mal claims, it is an infinitesimally small proportion of that number. So the flip side is it fair to all of us to put at risk our access to the world-class healthcare up here by not trying to find some balance in the system? And again, moving back to your question, my point would be, if it were my loved one or someone I cared about that were injured, no amount of money would be enough. But again, I understand that as a society, there are limits beyond which we simply can't afford to continue to do business the way we've been doing it.
And in the healthcare field and in medical liability insurance,
we've reached that limit.
Senator Huggins first.
Senator Huggins, go ahead. Dr. Huggins, Senator Huggins here, Wasilla. Question for you on the case that Senator French was citing. Let's say that the amount was $400,000 for his wrist. Are you familiar with how much the patient gets and how much his lawyer gets?
Well, there are some national numbers on that break out the dollar on a dollar basis, how much goes to plaintiff's attorneys, defense attorneys, administrative costs, and ultimately to the injured victim. It's, I think, less than 50% of the dollar actually gets to the injured person, and a lot of the rest of the cost is eaten up by, quite frankly, the system.
Right. So the person that was wronged, and in this case Senator Fritch's bad wrist, he would get a couple hundred thousand dollars of it, and the rest of it would go someplace else.
Well, That's what I understand, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a point of clarification. I was only asking...
Just a second, Senator French. Senator French, please. Go ahead.
I was only asking $5,000 for the wrist.
No, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to make sure we had it for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hogan, you had said that, you know, we can't keep doing business the way we've been doing it. And in previous testimony, we have heard that there is a review panel process in statute that's prior to the court system, and that's often waived by the defense, and that's just the testimony that was given. I don't know that to be true or not. But I would like to ask you, it seems like the solution that we've presented pits fairness to victims against access to health care instead of trying to figure out a different way to do business versus the same way that we're doing business with maybe some different rules. And whether or not you can comment from your experience on kind of this review panel and why it isn't used prior to court, or why some mediation through this process isn't used that much, so maybe we can cut down on the attorney's fees and we can come to some resolution before things get to court.
Sure. I had a good conversation with Dr. Gower actually after he testified last week, and he's actually participated on those review panels and been on the receiving end of that review panel. And what he told me is that if a plaintiff in the review panel does not get the essentially verdict or the judgment that they require, plaintiff's attorneys just routinely ignore the opinion of the review panel and go to court anyway. And if it looks as though the physician is going to lose or the review panel finds against the physician, almost all of the time the cases are settled then and there. So it's just another step, another hurdle, another expense that physicians and insurance companies have to go through. And that's why I was told that particular step is routinely waived by physicians because they just view it as a waste of time.
So, if I may.
Go ahead, Senator Grass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make the record clear, we got the opposite testimony, so the truth probably somewhere in the middle, that, you know, the attorneys that testified said, look, if it goes to the review panel and they deny it, there's not a good chance in court, so we don't go forward. So at some point, maybe we can discuss the review panel more. But wouldn't it seem, and the doctor previously had testified, that there's other solutions out there? I mean, has your organization looked at other solutions to try to make this system work better versus trying to change the rules in the court?
We've talked about systemic changes, but quite frankly, they're really beyond the scope of this bill. And this type of legislation, has been analogized to, quite frankly, stopping the bleeding on a patient. If you're going to really heal a patient, heal the whole body, you've got to really talk about larger systemic changes that will take quite a while to implement and are really beyond the scope of this legislation. The physician community in this state and nationally feels that this type of legislation is critically important in the short term to address a real problem. And it must be remembered that even if this legislation passes, it will be a challenge in court. It was last time. And that appeal process takes between 3 and 6 years before it gets to the Alaska Supreme Court. During that entire time period, the uncertainty for the physician community and the insurance community remains. Now, is the law constitutional? So how do they set rates? How do they make determinations about doing business up here? Is it worth doing business in Alaska? Those questions all will remain. So there are no great short-term solutions. And quite frankly, the long-term systemic changes, medical courts and other things, will require a great deal of study and discussion, and I think are more appropriate in other legislation.
Thank you. If I may, just one.
Go ahead, Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, if at any point you have anything in a written form or even can shoot me an email about the systemic changes, I'd be interested in knowing the discussions that have been going on. And I guess the only last question I have is the only way rates go down is for more insurance companies to come in and for the market to do what it does best. Have you been told that we're going to actually get more coverage or more insurance companies coming into our market to then try to put some downward pressure on medical malpractice rates?
Our argument has never been and never will be, unless rates go out of sight, that this is an issue of medical malpractice insurance rates.
Okay.
It is about access to insurance.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. I did not know that.
Other questions? Senator Terrio?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. First of all, on Section 3 of the bill, the applicability on line 24, malpractice claims that are subject to an agreement to arbitrate.
What part of the bill?
It's page 2, line 24, the applicability. The language there that this act applies to suits against healthcare providers and to provide malpractice claims that are subject to an agreement to arbitrate. So I want to just understand how that language works.
Mr. Senator Terrio, is any agreement, any contract can have an arbitration agreement in the contract. In fact, it's becoming more and more common in sale of large ticket items, automobiles for an example, that there's, and financing contracts for automobiles, and there's a mandatory arbitration agreement in the agreement. It says if you have an agreement, you will submit to the arbitration prior to going to court. So I think this basically makes this act apply to those claims as well, those that are subject to an arbitration agreement as well as those that are subject to being brought to court just on the merits of the case.
Okay, so the limits would apply to the arbitration.
Right.
Okay, I just wanted to understand that.
Your doctor could, in a contract to provide services, have an arbitration agreement in his contract. And if you agree to it, you agree to it.
And the other question I have for you or the witness on teleconference, just regarding other states that have put the $250,000 cap on, do we have information here in the packet? What's the total number of states that have that limit?
Should have a copy of a sheet like this one here. Shows the most current that we were able to get of the states and what their limits are.
Okay, I'll look for that.
There are 22 states that cap non-economic damages at the current time, and I have a list of them, and I believe a copy of that should have been provided for everyone, wasn't it?
If not, then I can...
Well, as other people have questions, I'll look through here and see if I can find that.
Okay. No more questions for Mr. Hogan. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Hogan. We're going to skip around on the list here and go next to Pat Luby in Anchorage, at the Anchorage LIO. Ms. Luby, are you there?
Yes, Senator. Thank you.
Mr. Luby, go ahead and give us your testimony. We're eager to hear it, if you'll put yourself on the record.
Get up in the morning and think about how many people there's planned to hurt that day. However, mistakes do happen, even by skilled health professionals. AARP believes that our legislator should focus on preventing mistakes, focus on error reduction, not on damages. The tort system encourages providers to cover up mistakes to avoid lawsuits rather than report errors and learn how to prevent them. Let's not think about lawyers or doctors or insurance companies. Let's think about our citizens. If someone is hurt by a medical mistake, they're entitled to some fair compensation. But what is more important is to make sure errors are reported so that we can learn how to prevent them in the future. AARP thinks that the $250,000 damages are too low for non-economic damages. Older people who have limited income potential based on life expectancy will get less in economic damages than younger persons who are victims of a similar error. The Institute of Medicine has proposed testing non-judicial, no-fault alternatives to the tort system for medical errors. If Alaska would adopt one of the IOM recommendations, it would foster fair compensation and error reduction. AARP feels that error reduction should be the real goal of consumer-oriented reform. Under the Institute of Medicine approach, compensation would be based on avoidability of errors rather than negligence. The ILM recommends preset schedules for compensation with reasonable limits that may help stabilize malpractice insurance. Providers would be required to report errors and make prompt compensation payments. The Institute of Medicine believes that mandated reporting of errors would help experts find system-wide ways to prevent them in the future. The system would then continually improve patient safety. With fewer errors, the cost of compensating injured people would decline. We would have fair and speedy compensation and fewer medical errors. AARP thinks that we can all live with that. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Luby? Seeing none, Mr. Luby, this is Senator Seekins, and I don't see anything in this bill or any other bill that I know of that would try to cover up medical errors. But we do appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you very much. Let's go next to Donna McCready from Anchorage. Donna, are you there with us this morning?
Yes, thank you, Senator Seekins.
We need you to put your name on the record for us, and then we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Donna McCready. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm also a member of the Alaska Action Trust. I testified before on this legislation in front of Labor and Commerce, and I have a couple of comments this morning listening to Mr. Hogan's testimony. First of all, Mr. Hogan testifies about his concern for access to medical care in Alaska. I understand that. I'm a consumer of medical services in this state. I certainly have a concern about access to medical care. But I'm also very, very concerned about access to justice. And this bill, were it to pass, would deny individual Alaskans access. And let me give you a scenario. If you have a physician who hypothetically is drinking late into the evening and has to be on call the following morning, and the physician gets up the next morning and let's just say he's got a hangover. And let's just say this particular physician is a surgeon who's performing surgery on a child that following morning, and due to his negligence or even recklessness, he causes the death of that child. I will tell you that the parent, if this bill were passed, the parents of that child could not afford to bring a case against that physician in Alaskan court. And the reason why is because economists do not place a very high value on the life of a child. They do not place a very high value on the life of the elderly, retired homemakers. Those folks do not have high economic damages. They have not economic damages of $250,000 when it costs well over $100,000 to bring a medical malpractice case in the state. Those are potential costs that any attorney who takes these cases on has to realize that, in fact, it could cost that much. They're not going to be able to take that case, and that family is going to be denied access to the courts and denied justice. My concern in terms of balancing access to justice versus access to medical care is that I just want to echo Senator Gass's question about how else systemically can we address what is being described as a problem in the state. And let me just stop there for a moment. I'm still really uncertain about what the problem is that we're talking about. There have been the number of medical malpractice cases brought in the state has been steady, perhaps not even declining. The payouts in these cases have been steady, and I think the data shows it's not steady, perhaps even declining. Mr. Hogan testified that there are 30 million contacts between patients and physicians in this state, and an infinitesimal percentage involves malpractice. So really, what is the problem here? And if there really is a problem with doctors getting insurance coverage, we still have not heard a response to the question, so why have we not gone back to the Medical Indemnity Corporation Act that was in place in the 1970s. which my understanding from what I've read about it was actually very successful in terms of giving physicians the coverage that they needed in male practice cases. I think in our state we've always had a couple of two or three dominant carriers in the industry, in the medical malpractice arena. And so the fact that there are two dominant insurers left in the state, and I don't hear any testimony from any of these insurance companies, any testimony under oath that either one of them is going to pull out of Alaska. But again, if that was a threat, why are we not talking about the solution of MICA, which was very successful early on the last time there was a concern expressed about coverage for physicians in this state? In response to one of Senator Huggins' questions about how much money goes to plaintiffs who bring these cases, patients who bring these cases, and how much goes to attorneys, I will tell you, as a practicing attorney, very typical for medical practice attorneys to charge a third of the recovery plus their costs, because there's a great deal of risk in taking these cases. As you know, verdicts in these cases are by and far in favor of physicians and not in favor of patients. And when patients take on these cases against their doctors, they are risking having a judgment against them because of rulings to fees and costs in this state. It's not a rule in every other state. And it's not only that, so attorneys may get a third, and attorneys compromise those fees as a matter of practice in certain cases, but it's generally a third plus cost. What the patient also has to worry about, however, are other wounds. If they've got medical costs that they've incurred because of the negligence of a physician, they generally have to pay those costs back. If their insurance company, such as Blue Cross Blue Shield, had paid for some of their medical expenses, well, they may have to pay Blue Cross Blue Shield back. So some of the money goes to what we call subrogation claims. And so, as you can see, if you've got a non-economic damages cap of $250,000, a patient really cannot, or is going to have a very difficult time getting access to the court system because of the expense of bringing such a case. I've probably spoken too long, and I'm trying to answer any questions that the panel may have.
Questions for Ms. McCready? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCready, you mentioned that recovery in medical malpractice claims is difficult, and jury verdicts frequently go against you. I recently looked at a study that the Rand Corporation did. The title of the study was "Capping Non-Economic Awards in Medical Malpractice Trials: California Jury Verdicts Under MICRA," and it was the study points out that about 22% of California medical malpractice trials during their study period resulted in a verdict in favor of one or more of the plaintiffs, compared with 53% for all other types of trials. So what this RAND study said was that only about 1 in 5 cases do you actually get a jury verdict in your favor versus about 50% in other cases. And I'm wondering whether that study comports with your experience trying these cases here in Alaska.
Well, I'm sitting next to Michael Schneider, who's also a practitioner in the state. It's probably a smaller percentage that comes out in favor of plaintiffs. And again, because you have the hammer of really two fees and costs, it's so risky for a patient to actually take one of these cases to trial. And yes, it's a very, very small percentage that come out in favor of patients.
Ms. McCready, and this is Senator Seekins. How many medical malpractice cases have you tried?
Have I tried? You know, I've only tried one, Senator Seekins.
How many medical malpractice claimants have you represented?
Sorry, I don't have that number, probably doing the 10.
So
less than 100, certainly, but in the...
And only, and most of those that you represented were settled prior to trial?
Yes, Well, first of all, let me just say, Senator Seekins, that I get calls all the time about medical malpractice claims. I probably take probably between 2 and 5% of cases where I get called. And often I'll spend a fair amount of money investigating a case, and I may spend, you know, several thousands of dollars investigating a case and then not take that case because, you know, I feel like, well, it maybe has merit, but we're not going to actually be able to prove that there was negligence, and I'm not going to put this person at risk of taking them through the system when ultimately it may not prevail.
But in that regard, though, of those that you did accept,
most of those settled.
All but one?
Yes, that's correct. In my history of doing these cases.
And those would be greater than 50, greater than 75, less than 100? What range?
In terms of, I'm sorry, dollars?
That you've accepted that you did not take to trial.
Okay, I guess I would break it down this way. Of all the cases, of all the calls I get, I probably take between 2 and 5% of those cases in the door to investigate and take further. Probably, I would say, I'm kind of going off my memory here, right. Probably about 25% to 50% of those cases, I will spend some amount of money investigating them and then not take them on, or either dismiss them, not take them forward. And then if that percentage of that's left, yes, all but one I have settled.
Okay. Do you have an example of a case that would look anything like this drunk homicide that you described earlier?
I did not personally handle a case like that. I have read about a physician with a significant drinking problem. Sorry, I read about two physicians with significant drinking problems who were then engaged in surgery. And one physician I read about actually had, in fact, performed a surgical procedure on a child the day after he was drinking way into the night.
And
I did not handle that case.
Yeah. Are you familiar of, I mean, could you maybe refer us to any case like that so that we could take a look at it? I mean, I've heard of these cases before, and they're all hypothetical to me, and I'm just wondering if I could ever find one that I could take a look at.
And actually, the state medical board certainly would have, well, this is one of the difficult things, Senator Seekins, where I look for information about physicians and their past conduct. A lot of times I am met with the difficulty of, well, files are confidential, details about cases are confidential. But certainly, being pointed out to me that right now the state board does have disciplinary actions, which includes disciplinary actions on physicians that are alcohol-related.
Yeah, well, I'm not a prosecutor, but if I heard about a case like that, I think I'd probably try him for negligent homicide more than medical malpractice.
Well, Senator, if this bill is written, that case scenario would, that physician and damages against such a physician would be limited to $250,000.
And if you were a defendant's lawyer and someone brought you a case like that, do you think you would take it to court?
Well, I've never actually been in the position of defending doctors, Senator Seekins. And my experience with these cases is that there's very, very good counsel representing doctors. Doctors in the state have excellent representation. There's a few attorneys who specialize in this, and they're quite good. And they, of course, are doing their job in defending their clients and trying to protect their reputation. And I'm trying to think if I've had any case where I've had a case settled right off the bat because a doctor says, you know, something went wrong here and I'm willing to take responsibility. Usually I have to go through quite a bit of discovery until you can get to that point.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. McCready, for your testimony today. And I heard that you mentioned a Michael Schneider. I think he's on the list. Mr. Schneider, would you like to just follow up at this point? And if you would, please put your name on the record, and we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Senator Seekins, Chairman Seekins, and members of the committee. I would like to share with you just a few, you know, we could talk all day about this, but I want to get out a couple ideas and then I'll leave you alone. First of all, the Alaska history. There is no place you can go to get perfectly accurate records about this, but I pay very close attention. I have for many years, and everybody that calls me about a medical malpractice case, I tell them this. I say, look, there have been maybe 15, probably less, maybe 15 verdicts for plaintiffs in medical negligence cases broadly defined in the history of the state and territory of Alaska. And while you can't absolutely disprove that, I don't believe, I'm pretty sure that's correct. This is the great, big, huge problem we're here to deal with, 15 crummy verdicts. I've got one of them. Dawes got one of them. Dawes was actually a pretty good one. Mine came in at a great big $75,000. This is not a huge problem in this state. I think that somebody mentioned some statistics suggesting that these cases are won by defendants 80% of the time in down in America. Well, this ain't down in America. We don't win 20% of these cases up here. We win a much smaller percentage. In my 30-year career, I have done very few of these cases, maybe, I'm going to say, 6 or 7. The main point that I want to make today is that the fit between the goal of the legislation and this bill is just very, very, it's a poor fit. Insurance companies, Elliot Spitzer, in his testimony to the U.S. Senate Government Affairs Committee, pointed out that, I'm going to say in the year 2003, I may be off by here, insurance premiums accounted for $1 out of every $10 in the gross domestic product. $1 out of every $10. The industry, according to him, and if payments by the people he's chasing are any indication, is rampant with fraud and abuse. It is completely unregulated. And this is the industry that will benefit by this bill. It's the, you know, you're giving away the rights of your constituents to ask a jury. Doesn't mean the jury's going to do them any good, but to ask a jury, you're taking away their rights to ask for something fair, and you're giving the farm away to an unregulated industry who makes most of its money not on the premiums that account for 10% of the gross domestic product, but on their reserve income. Now, the fix that's proposed in this bill is not new. Indeed, it is ancient. Decades ago, Ontario, Canada had these kinds of caps and tort claims in general. And so as these insurance crises pop up every few years, big surprise, the folks in Ontario are dealing with the same problems of affordability and availability that physicians that you have been hearing from are facing now. Now, lawyers aren't always the smartest folks on the bus, but we get a few things right once in a while. And many years ago, we were facing huge problems, just like physicians, of affordability and availability of professional errors and omissions coverage. So, having a keen grasp of the obvious, a couple IQ points to rub together, we all got together, and it became real obvious real quick that we weren't the problem, and our clients, who didn't sue us, kind of like doctors, didn't sue us very often, didn't win very often when they did, they weren't the problem. The insurance industry was the problem. So what we did to address that problem was we formed an insurance pool. First, we investigated its feasibility, found it was way feasible, and an outfit called ALPS, Attorneys Liability Protection Society, or something like that, was formed. ALPS has gone into more and more states, and of course it began in small states like Alaska and Montana, Wyoming, Kentucky, and whoever else out there. It has never left the state it has entered. It remains profitable to this day. It provides attorneys with affordable, available insurance, and it will continue to do so. And because it's attorney owned, it is an excellent alternative to other insurance vehicles in the market. Donna mentioned the experience of my aunt. That's right. A good Republican.
Mr. Snyder, I think I and almost all the members are very familiar with the MICA system, so you don't need to go into a big definition of it. We're very aware of it.
Very good. I point out former Senator Taylor is a pretty good source of information in addition to the public record there.
I figured by your testimony he'd already talked to you.
Actually, he hasn't already talked to me, but I have seen correspondence and some old documents about the success of this, and I'm aware of his personal feelings.
Yeah, he and I have discussed this at great length, so let's go ahead.
I suspect that all of you are aware of a pretty small percentage that of total costs that are accounted for by medical negligence claims. The Government Accounting Office has got a lot of statistics on this. Virtually none of them support the efficacy of cap legislation like this. And I can assure each member of the committee that if you passed a law completely eliminating general damages, I mean got rid of them, the physicians that you are appropriately concerned about will face the same crises of affordability and availability in the future, just like they have in the past, because it's a cyclical phenomenon driven by fluctuations in the industry's return on reserve income. It's got zip to do with premiums. It's got zip to do with claims. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Snyder, Charlie Huggins here, Wasilla. Question for you, what did you call your group insurance that you formed?
ALPS, attorney, Senator, I think it's attorneys, I should know, I got stock in this out there, but I think it's Attorney Liability Protection Society, or something like that.
Yeah, very good. In the last 24 months, could you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of how many suits have been filed against you?
None. In fact, if you wanted to extend that over the last 29 years and 9 months, the answer would be the same. Nevertheless, I pay a pretty good, you know, I could go run in Africa every year for what it costs me to buy E&O coverage, but I think it's the responsible thing to do, so I do it.
No, I understand. I guess I'm, it appears to me it's a case of apples and oranges that, I don't know, at least in my mind, there appears to be a significant number of cases where doctors have suit brought against them. And in your case, you're talking about the insurance, but it doesn't appear that you should have any concern about somebody suing you.
No, Senator, I respectfully, very respectfully, think that you misunderstand the playing field completely, and let me explain why. If you are a plaintiff's attorney, you evaluate cases. You know, this is what I think about my cases. If what I thought about my cases counted, I retired 15 years ago. It's what juries will think about our cases. So, attorneys are, I am sad to report, you know, we're kind of up there with car salesmen, and I'm no offense, politicians, and you guys have all read the same studies I have.
Mr. Snyder, this is Chairman Seekins. I'm both a car salesman and a politician. So.
then, Senator, you and I are honored in many ways all at the same time.
And I have a son who's a lawyer, so.
I think all the members of the committee understand the point I'm making. The attorney malpractice claims are easier cases. They are easier cases. An attorney malpractice claim, all the facts and the damages, equal, you take an attorney malpractice claim 10 times quicker than you take a medical malpractice claim. So that's just a very, very important point. Attorney malpractice claims are easier. People walk in that courtroom, jurors, your constituents, thinking that doctors are akin to God. They walk in that courtroom thinking that attorneys are not. Maybe we're more akin to the devil. So the claims experience of lawyers and our success with outfits like ALPS, if anything, drives the point home. If we can make that system successful, affordable, available, and protect our
Thank you very much. I do want to just for everyone's information, I've taken a look at the MICA program. I've talked to great extent with former Senator Robin Taylor, who used to be chair of this committee and has been a good friend of mine for a long time. I've taken a look at the structure of both of the major carriers in the state of Alaska, both of which are mutual companies, which basically are an insurance pool. They're owned by doctors who pay into their premiums in there, and any reduction in claims or any income that would come from any reserves acts as a refund to the doctor in terms of their insurance premium. So in looking at the MICA system, for an example, we would in effect be creating another mutual company within the state of Alaska that would be confined to the physicians within the state of Alaska, and would require, I have various estimates, somewhere between $40 and $50 million upfront funding for reserves to be able to make that switch, which would probably then have to be, if we were to choose to go that direction again in the state of Alaska, be upfronted by the state of Alaska. As we've gone through this for the record, we've taken a look at all the different alternatives that would be available to physicians within the state to make this a more attractive marketplace to be able to recruit younger physicians and replacement physicians as the universe of our physicians in the states grows older and wants to retire. So that you guys all know and everyone knows, the MICA system has not escaped our view, and we've done quite a bit of extensive research already, and we're not done yet, taking a look to see if the MICA system could be put in place for the benefit of physicians within the state. So that is under consideration as well as we go forward, for the record, so everyone knows. I was just curious, Mike, while we're talking, and by the way, since I am a used car salesman, as I say, I've always figured that politicians and lawyers kept me two notches higher up on the level of public confidence than I otherwise would be, so I've always appreciated both professions. and I do have a son who's an attorney, and I still love him, and he still loves me. What I was curious about, if this is not a big problem, as you say, in the state of Alaska, there aren't these big jury verdicts out there, then what's the problem with capping it?
The problem with capping it is that it denies your most seriously, unfairly injured constituents their constitutional right to go to a jury of their peers to evaluate their claim. And while you are denying that essential American freedom, you are getting in return for it not one thing. That's the problem. I'd like to make another point along those lines. Senator Sessions, in one of his questions, brought out the reality that most of these cases get resolved. Okay? I would ask the members of the committee to think about this. In a setting where these cases are virtually never won in Alaska when they're tried, and they're won 20% down in America when they're tried, how good does your case have to be as a plaintiff to get the industry to pay you money for it? These cases are aggressively screened. You got to have a lead pipe cinch case, and then they still won't pay you for them. You've got to think, I would encourage the committee to think about the harm you're doing to your constituents, who right now, you could have a constituent with a lead pipe cinch $250,000 case, and they will play heck finding a lawyer to take it. They probably won't get an attorney to take it.
It's interesting to me that you say that. I'm going to have to spread that around in the back of my mind, because $100,000 plus costs, what would normally go into the category costs?
Well, let me give you an idea. We can't prove these cases out of our mouths because they are inherently technical. Expert testimony is required to support them. That expert testimony will be met by opposing expert testimony. These people are scattered all over the place. Airplane tickets cost a lot of money. These experts cost a lot of money. I had a case one time a medical negligence case that settled after one half of one deposition for a fairly significant amount of money. I think my out-of-pocket cost bill was $45,000. It is hugely expensive to develop these cases, and the plaintiff's attorney cannot control the expense because you don't know entirely what you're going to be met with. And if somebody shows up with a nuclear bomb, you got to go buy your own. It's just very difficult. It's hugely risky. So if one of your constituents comes to you complaining about what sounds like a huge medical error that's taken their life and ruined it, I can assure the members of this committee they're going to have one heck of a time getting legal representation.
So I still need to know just what is included in the category called costs. Are depositions in that
sure.
category?
No.
Expert testimony in that category?
If I have to retain an expert, that is a cost. If I make copies of documents, those are costs. If I have to get on an airplane and travel to southern Egypt to talk to the right witness, that's a cost.
The court recorder and the...
All that stuff.
All that. So everything other than your direct legal expense for your hours?
Yes, the value of the time of me, my staff, and my expert is what the fee is for. Everything else, everything you write a check for is a cost.
And so what would you normally, so that I understand it. Because I'm not an attorney, I don't know how you bill. So you charge, let's say hypothetically, $200 an hour. What does that cost? Is that included in that? Is that all your staff people, your preparation, or do you charge for the support staff that you would also use as part of the costs figure?
No, here's how it works on the plaintiff's side of the fence. On the defense side, the people that represent doctors that are sued, okay? They charge for everybody. Their support staff is billed out at a rate, the attorneys are billed out at various rates, and their out-of-pocket expenses are covered. On the plaintiff's side, our clients can't afford to order lunch. They can't help us with any of these things. So the plaintiff's attorney gets paid for his time and his overhead by the percentage fee. Now, his direct litigation costs associated with that file are an additional cost. So if I charge one-third of the gross recovery, that is for my fee, the time of my paralegal assistant, my secretary, my overhead, and all that sort of thing. But if I have to have a specific expense related to that file, everything from copy charges to retaining expert witnesses, that is an additional amount of money that I front and that it is taken out of my client's gross recovery if we are successful. I mean,
okay.
This is not for the faint of heart.
Right. I see that. Now, of the $75,000 claim that you said that you got in this, what you called a crummy verdict of $75,000, how much of that did you take? One-third of that $25,000 plus cost? Is that what you would look at?
Yes, it's an interesting case, and it really illustrates the problem. So let me give the committee just a few more of the details. The person I was representing was a terminal Alzheimer's person, okay? She was burned over the most private, delicate area of her body, first, second, and third degree burns by some act of abject medical stupidity. She was, she's about to die. This didn't look like a big case. I took it because it just frankly made me so damn mad I couldn't see straight. So we tried to settle a case for $75,000. They wouldn't give us $75,000. We went to trial, got $75,000. The out-of-pocket cost bill in that case, lowest you'll ever hear about in a medical negligence case, was around $25,000. In order to give the Connolly, the survivors, half of the money. I reduced my fee because I thought it was the right thing to do, so I got at least half the loot. But, you know, it illustrates the problem. You can see terrible injustices, take them on, and economically you can't make a fly. That's why people that face those kind of difficulties can't get legal representation.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Thank you.
Let's move next to back to the off-net, and we'll move to Mike Powers. Mr. Powers, are you online with us this morning?
Yes, I am.
If you put yourself on the record for us, we're going to hear your testimony this morning, sir.
Very good. Mike Powers, Administrator at Fairbanks Memorial. Fairbanks, Alaska. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary, thanks for the opportunity. I think Senator Gass hit it on the head when she talked about struggling or pitting this issue of fairness and victims against in levels of compensation against access to care. And I know this is an extremely difficult issue for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to address it. It's important always to remember that we are not talking about gross levels of negligence or incompetence or recklessness or poor performance. Surely those must be compensated fairly. I'd like to address a few issues regarding this level of access from our perspective at Fairbanks. As I look at studies around the nation and I see what this $250,000 cap on non-economic damages means, it appears to me there is reason to explore this as well as some of the other systemic issues that have been referred to, whether it's the Institute of Medicine recommendations or arbitration or medical error improvements, expert witness standards, etc. But out of the $250,000 cap in Texas, where voters recently enacted that cap, they have seen a decrease in rates of 17%. And the general sense is they feel they're around the corner to addressing some of these access issues. In California, of course, which is the landmark study we hear so much about, the $250,000 cap has resulted in the highest reported rate for an OBGYN was $89,953, and then in Illinois, where the state Supreme Court struck down previously passed caps, the highest rate was $230,000. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Illinois at the end, and I think I may have some information that may be helpful in your deliberations. In Nebraska, physicians pay some of the lowest premiums in the country. They credit tort reforms first enacted in the 70s. Creating an environment conducive to practice for physicians. Michigan has some reforms, including very high
Mr. Powers? Mike?
Yeah.
Could I ask you just, Senator French had a question. We didn't hear something there.
I'm sorry, Ms. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Powers, but could you go back over that state that had some of the lowest rates in the nation? I thought I heard you say Nebraska, but I wasn't sure.
Yes, that's correct.
Nebraska.
Right.
Thank you.
Some of the lowest premiums.
And that's a state without caps?
No, they do have caps. They're crediting their tort reform. I believe they have caps. I don't have that.
The chart we were given this morning, a January 2005 chart for medical economics distributed to the committee, doesn't list Nebraska as one of those states, but maybe it's more recent.
No, you could be right. I do know that some of the aggressive other tort reforms starting back in the 70s were important, and that gets back to this issue of this systemic issue. It's not obviously but a single solution, a single bullet, it's multifaceted.
Well, we'll check this out because it could be a general non-economic damages cap that wouldn't be picked up as medical malpractice, but we'll check it. Thank you. Go ahead.
In addition, I know that Pennsylvania, of course, with their $250,000 cap on damages, has reduced losses and defense costs by 18%. In other words, around the country, we're seeing this issue of caps is very important to creating additional access for physicians, creating an environment that's conducive to practice. We in Fairbanks currently have a shortage of 10 internal medicine physicians, 4 psychiatrists, 3 OBGYNs, 2 cardiologists, and 2 ophthalmologists. We're in an aggressive recruiting campaign. In 2004, we sent out 35,000 packets of information to internal medicine docs. We've received 5 responses. We have no active leads with these internal medicine docs. We're doing the same in ENT and in psych, which is a real crisis in Fairbanks at the moment. We sent out 15,000 of these packets for pulmonary medicine, and we have 1 lead. In other words, this really is a hot, difficult issue for us. Just last night, as I was exploring a little bit of information, I came across something which I will send you. I think you'll find helpful in your discussions. The Illinois Senate Judiciary Committee 2 weeks ago took up this issue. Medical malpractice insurance hearing, I don't know if you've come across this yet or not. Their objective was essentially 2 Milliman consultants to compute the reduction to medical malpractice in loss expenses that would result from capping non-economic damages. Real quickly, they evaluated reductions for physicians and hospitals. They specifically looked at New York, Pennsylvania, Florida, Wyoming, and Maryland. They tapped their data sources with a national practitioner database, Florida Department of Insurance database, Texas Insurance database, et cetera. And what they found was that the $250,000 cap, a reduction of in these losses of 24% in New York, Florida a reduction of 17%, Wyoming a reduction of 15%, Pennsylvania a reduction of 11%. There's a grid here which says, okay, what is it at 500,000, 750, and 1 million? And I think this study will be helpful for you, and I will be sure to pass that on. I want to just simply conclude and come back again to Senator Guest saying, okay, we're really talking about pitting this issue of fairness against creating access. We are just having a heck of a time trying to get physicians in Fairbanks, and we as a state are in general, and we'll continue to see this with obviously the demographics, the baby boom freight train headed our way. I urge you to carefully consider the study I'm going to forward to you, and seriously consider the $250,000 cap as an important part of a systemic fix.
Okay, questions for Senator Guest.
Thank you, Mr. Powers, and I look forward to reading that study. Earlier, Mr. Hogan had stated that, at least in his opinion, it's not about rates but about access. But a lot of the statistics that you noted were about rates going down, not about increased access to medical malpractice insurance. Can you talk from your opinion whether or not, and when it comes to recruiting more doctors, if you're talking about a problem of rates and or of access?
I really think it is both. We are talking about access, and hopefully the numbers that I shared with you on 10 internal medicine physicians short, which really are the backbone of a health system, in my opinion, suggest what a concern it is. When we do recruit, medical malpractice is a concern, is asked about. But again, and I think this is what you have said, what Senator Seekins is asking is, it's part of a huge issue. This is no single solution at all. So to answer your question, it is only a part of our discussions in recruiting. If we drop rates by 50%, I don't think we're going to continue to have a flood. We sure are going to make a more favorable environment to practice that will help, but it's not the single answer.
Go ahead, Senator Guest.
And then I guess I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hogan. Have you had any conversations with insurance companies that say they'll actually come into the state if we cap damages? My real concern is, I think part of having fewer insurance companies is just being so small, and the only way you really get rates down versus insurance companies making more profits are having more insurance companies come into a market. And that goes to rates. And we haven't had any of the insurance companies come to testify.
Yeah, good question. I have not talked with them. I do think it's an important part of probably what I need to do before the session ends, but I have.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Terrio?
Thank you. With regard to being able to attract doctors, I missed testimony on this bill previously. Perhaps it was covered, but what is happening as far as number of applicants going through medical schools in the nation? Is that sort of the graduation of doctors, is that held steady and yet we're not able to attract them up here? Are they all going to warmer climates? Can you give me just some information on what's happening on the national front with regards to production of doctors?
Sure, a couple things. My sense is it's holding steady. Others may have better information than I do. The concern we have is the with the younger physicians, the lifestyle issue is important to them, and they want an environment where they can either share or eliminate call in a way that is conducive to raising young families. That's big. The practice environment, we're still struggling with making Alaska attractive to those who wouldn't first think of Alaska, and that is a real recruiting issue. But in short, I think production is remaining steady. There's as you well know, this tremendous bubble moving forward with the baby boom that is demanding more and more services. And we find ourselves in Fairbanks just trying to make the case this is a wonderful environment to practice. There's lifestyle issues and it's a struggle.
Okay, and then with regards to rates, we have some information in our packet here that I was skimming over that talked about the insurance field through a period of time in, I think it was the 80s and 90s. That the premiums actually went down, that it was very competitive in the state of Alaska. You had new entrants into the insurance market that perhaps were pricing the insurance product below what was reasonable. And there was some talk that there would be a shakeout in the market and that the rates would start to harden and come back to a more realistic point. So I'm wondering just, do you have, what kind of history do you have with regards to the premiums paid for by the hospital, by the doctors practicing at the hospital, whether they did for a period of time go down, went beyond, down beyond what was reasonable, and part of the increase was just a correction in the market?
Yeah, I can't speak for the physicians. I can say that is what happened at Fairbanks Memorial. Our numbers would indicate in the late 80s and early 90s there was a tremendous run-up in costs. In the mid-90s, a flattening because we are self-insured because of our reserves. However, in the last 5 years, our malpractice insurance has gone from $700,000 to $2 million, an increase of about 276% in 5 years. So we're seeing that dramatic run-up in this last 5 years. We did have a period of flattened costs.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator French.
Mr. Powers, I'm sure in your business you are more than well acquainted with the problem of inflation and the general upward pressure on costs as you try to go about administering your business there at Fairbanks Memorial. And I guess my question is about the effect of inflation. The same RAND study I was citing earlier about the percentage of cases that are won and lost by plaintiffs in these cases also took a look at the effect of inflation on these non-economic damages caps. And I think you would agree that you have to kind of take into account inflation because just like everything else, the prices are going up. And this RAND study noted that if you'd taken that $250,000 cap that California instituted in 1975 and adjusted it for the Consumer Price Index, the cap would be $708,000 in 1995 and $774,000 in 1999. Do you think that inflation, maybe you'd just like to comment on that and comment on your approach to dealing with increased costs and whether or not patients should also be able to index their claims for inflation?
It seems reasonable they should to me. What that is, I don't know. I do know that in Michigan, they have indexed those premiums to inflation. They're now over, their non-economic cap is now over $350,000. and I know the Michigan State Medical Society is really concerned about it, having trouble affecting that cap rate, and so they're looking at expert witness standards and other mechanisms. But ultimately, and this gets to Senator Gass too, I'm not going to, you know, ever say this is, it is clearly, we're trying to create access, but in order to create access, we need to have a reasonable cap level. And that's why I think that 250 is so important. Coming all the way back, yes, some type of index is important. I do want to point out, Michigan tying it to the CPI, it may not be the best method.
Thank you. Mr. Powers, I'm assuming, just for the record, how long have you been at the hospital there?
I'll be 19 years in July.
In that time, I'm sure you had been involved in lawsuits for medical malpractice?
Yes.
How many of those would you say that you may have, without any, just roughly, a rough universe in 20 years?
I would say we see some type of legal question, maybe 5 to 10 a year. We have seen more recently that, in my opinion, are would be characterized as nuisance in the last 5 years.
And how many of those have gone to court?
I'm going to guess maybe a quarter of them.
In your opinion, when I'm sure you've been involved in discussions as to whether or not this court this case has merits, or whether it should be settled prior to going to court. In your opinion, from the hospital's perspective, and in working with your insurance coverage and their attorneys, is what's the general attitude? Do you try to settle these before you get to court, or?
You know, about 2000 would just settle out of court. My opinion in the last 5 years is we're not going to. We are going to go to the mat, and if it costs us a little bit more, we have to draw a line in the sand because it's too frivolous. It's too easy. Somebody's got to say no, and so we have absorbed some additional costs just by not taking the tougher stand.
And the ones you take to court are the ones you think have no merit?
Yes. Yeah. Now, if something does have merit, you're always working with the individual, and surely mistakes are made. But generally, that we take to I misspoke there. We take to court those that have no merit.
Senator French?
Mr. Powers, is it they have no merit, or is it that you just can't come to terms to settle them?
Can't give a black and white answer on that. Some simply have absolutely no merit, and as I say, we have seen, just this past year, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it costs, we've got $35,000 wrapped up in defending something in the last 3 months, absolutely no merit, and the decision was made in 15 minutes. So the level of nuisance lawsuits recently has been very noticeable to me.
Okay, Senator French, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what's been your experience in front of Fairbanks juries? Are they willing to shell out money against the hospital, or do they typically say no?
You know, they tend to be fairly tough,
very tough.
They are not. Even though the hospital is often viewed as a deep pockets, I would say that the general Fairbanks jury is fairly stringent.
I think by reputation it is. Senator Gass.
Yes. Mr. Powers, we've discussed through the last couple of hearings the review panel, which is currently in statute. Do you have any opinion on whether that works or doesn't work and why it may or may not work?
No, I wish I did. I'm sorry I don't.
Thank you.
In looking at that review panel, just to follow up on that, Mr. Powers, I noticed that a member of the review panel is paid a fee of, I think, of up to $150 a day, max. Do you know many doctors that we can hire for $150 a day?
It's interesting. What I think every hospital in the state would talk about what they are doing now in order to pay physicians for chairing medical staff departments, for taking call in the ER, for doing a number of things. The burden on physicians is absolutely incredible these days in their expectations. Surely is with hospital too, for a number of reasons. But moving into medicine these days is, I think many physicians are advising their sons and daughters to think twice because of the onerous regulatory environment, and to pay someone. They've got to be in their practice taking care of patients in order to sustain a reasonable living.
So to spend $2-3 reviewing a medical malpractice case without really being paid for it wouldn't expect that we'd find a lot of volunteers?
We have a very difficult time finding volunteers for them.
Thank you, sir. Next person on our list, we're just about done, but we have Kathy Dale from Anchorage. Kathy, are you there?
Thank you for letting me speak to you today. I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 67, and I represent my husband, myself, and my family. We are victims of medical malpractice, and this bill is not going to harm us, but it is going to harm any future victims and your constituents. The only way that we found out what about my husband's permanent brain damage and what the cause was because we were able to find an attorney that would take our case. And through working with expert witnesses and getting their testimony, we were able to find out what had happened to my husband. In the meantime, I lost my husband, the person that I knew. My children don't have the father that they knew, and my grandchildren will never know their grandfather as he was. And with lowering the cap is going to protect negligent doctors. It's not going to help the victims or the patients. It's also not going to bring qualified physicians into the state, and it's not going to lower medical malpractice premiums. There already is a $400,000 cap on non-economic damages in Alaska, and I'm asking you to leave that cap at $400,000. I'm not asking you to increase it. I'm asking you not to decrease it. But lowering the cap will prevent lower-income people, the retired children, from being able to file suit. It's going to keep Medicaid, Medicare, and the PERS retirement system from recovering their medical costs because these suits will never be brought and the subrogation claims will never be paid. People have already testified what the $250,000 cap established in 1976 is equal to in current dollars. So I won't go through that again. But anybody who lives in Anchorage knows how much their home evaluations have gone up in the last 2 years. Ours has doubled. We haven't done anything to our home, and we've lived in the same home for 36 years. So I think that we are all feeling the effect of inflation. And I'm just asking you to not enact this bill and to leave the cap stand at $450,000. And I know that people keep addressing the fact that premiums in California have gone down, but that's more an act of the voters and their Proposition 103 than it is an act of the medical malpractice insurance companies and being magnanimous to the doctors. The impact of the medical malpractice premiums in the last few years was due to the stock market. When the risk pools lost their value, the premiums had to go up in order to put money back into those risk pools. Now that the stock market has regained some of its value, the risk pool should be up to what they need to be, and premiums should go down. That's an economic factor, it's just a function of pools. And medical malpractice carriers can assess their risk with a $400,000 cap as easily as they can with a $250,000 cap. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Dale? Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure since you've done a lot of research on this bill, you'd probably be the best one to answer this question, but the existing $400,000 cap, is that an absolute cap, or is there, in certain circumstances, you can go beyond that?
Under the existing law, it's a $400,000 cap that would then go to a $1 million cap if it was a severe injury, or which has been loosely defined in a recent state Supreme Court as something that would cause embarrassment. So you do have a soft cap there. It's not a hard cap. This would establish a hard cap.
Chairman, what was that decision? Because I'm not familiar with it.
I have it down in my office, but it's a decision that was on a case. It was actually not a medical malpractice case, but it was another tort case in, I think, out in Bethel or Western Alaska. A lady who slipped in a shower in a community center, and she's bow-legged in one leg and reverse bow-legged in the other leg, and the court decided that there was no definition of the word severe in statute, so they defined it as, and loosely, as anything which would cause embarrassment to the person who suffered the injury. So it's a in discussing it with some of the attorneys that were in the case, it appears as if the court basically said, since we don't have a definition of severe, we need to try to define it ourselves. And so I have a copy of it in my office somewhere. I'll see if I can get you a copy. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
So at this point, we would consider that $400,000 that exists in current law for tort in torts to be a soft cap. Any other questions? We do have one more person, and I'll get Mr. Well, I actually have two, but we're not going to cut off private public testimony. I do have Brian Slocum from the Tanawha Valley Clinic that's also in the Fairbanks LIO. Brian, are you there? Brian, can you hear us? You may be on mute, but we're actually at the limit of the time today. I'm not going to cut it off, and I will have staff get a hold of Mr. Jordan and Mr. Slocum both and tell them when we will next testify so we can fit them in. We do regret the fact that we started late today, but there was another function in the state capitol this morning, and some of our members needed to attend that, which caused us to start late. We will be on Tuesday. We will be here. Am I correct, Mr. Hove? We will continue on Tuesday morning with Senate Bill 67 and follow up right up with that on the second thing, which was our SJR 10. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, the case that you just referenced, I'd appreciate getting a copy
to
just
copy
so we understand how the current law works. And then also, we had some testimony about different states that
we'll research that. Pennsylvania and Nebraska were mentioned. We'll investigate that.
I don't know if there's a website or somewhere where we can really get information on what other states are currently doing. So I'd appreciate that.
This information came from Weiss Ratings, AMA, and National Conference of State Legislators. So we'll see if we can find something more authoritative than that. But we'll give it our best shot here. Thank you very much. And with that, the Judiciary Committee is adjourned.